And that was another one from Dave Lippmann, When the Farm Workers Come Marching In, or something like that. Now back to Brett Adams.
I'd rather be on the street.
No, they don't, but they're driven into the encampment, much like the people who were camped last year at the post office and in front of City Hall.
But I think some of them would.
At some point, they had no choice. As hard as they could to stay at the post office, they did not want to go down there. And finally, the police just forced everybody down in the same pit.
I think some people have said that to me as well. I'm just wondering if it's the majority sentiment. I have no idea, so... Anyway, are there other issues you want to raise that perhaps we haven't talked about in this conversation or before? Because we are going into the 35 to 40 minute zone. So.
Oh, are we? Well, yeah. These are the three topics. One is heat funding. So we haven't talked about that really at all. That we're focusing on laundry and infrastructure around transitional encampments. And drum roll, please. Leading towards tiny house encampments, but that's going to be a much larger conversation. Additionally, city council action, which either includes or doesn't some of that stuff about funding. And then finally, what we're trying to do with the coalition, which is we're having a meeting called the Revolutionary Meeting on February 11th. It's a Monday at 7 o'clock at Loudon Nelson, room number 1. We're probably going to move it to a much bigger room. This is where we're trying to share with the community at large, everybody, the NIMBYs, the haters, Cannery residents, your community of activists, everybody, to...
Out-of-town addicts.
Bring some awareness to the fact that we're caught in a housing-first paradigm, that there are... It's actually a list of needs. We're not housing people, finally. So let's talk about what's achievable based on what's elsewhere, but... The way we're going to have some of these things, now that we have the city council, progressive voting bloc, is we have to give them support by not, again, infighting about this, that, and the other, but really develop a cohesive concept, much like Drew is doing, much like your group is doing. But let's not waste this moment. We want to end up after these 2 years, because we might lose it in 2 years, with a real set of achievable things that are going to shift the needle completely and forever around homelessness. And what I want to say is 50 people in a sanctuary camp, 50 people in a transitional, in a safe encampment that exists forever, 50 to 100 people in car camping, and then towards the new navigation center or whatever, also laundry services, ample bathrooms and hygiene facilities, so that when the money goes away and when this council goes away, we're going to have some things for a very long-lasting time after, not just hand-washing stations. And, what they'll end up is giving us more porta-potties or needle boxes. We really have to go into the heart. And it's actually going to be nonprofits that fill in the breach. The city is not going to step up with $1 million on its own to establish some of these things. It's going to be the city finally working with a new cadre of nonprofits. They're kind of burnt and wary of the homeless services-centric concept. And nonprofits like mine, give it 10, 20 years, might turn out to be evil, bullshitty organizations like the Homeless Services Center. I'm sorry I said that, but for now we have to, get some of these things out of the gate.
So any reports from any of the other cities in terms of what's going on in San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, Los Angeles?
San Jose, Oakland, they have new encampments, but of course there's also reports of various encampments being pulled apart, like the one in Oakland. There are new things happening in Santa Rosa. I actually have to finally, maybe this summer, do another quick tour, because what we do is we kind of take this tour on Facebook and the newspapers, but without sort of going out there to see what they look like, what's happening on the West Coast. We want to get Santa Cruz out there, though. We kind of want to see this as a model city. If we have a Drew Glover and a Sandy Brown on, or a Justin Cummings on the city council, we could actually make this a model city for the entire West Coast around what's achievable.
Mm-hmm. Now, on a completely different subject, you and I may have run into each other initially in terms of your street performing activities when police were, shall we say, taking a narrow view of street performers on Pacific Avenue. Any reports at all on anything going on down there?
Not really. I think the same thing is that first of all, the Rangers have replaced the hosts, and that, now we have a new sort of, you know, they have new, what do they call the new people that are associated with the Downtown Association?
Ambassadors, maybe?
Ambassadors, yeah.
I'm not sure.
But what's true is I think the new brass discs on the ground and, an actual one-hour limit for cabling and for street performing, but you still see these people out there for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. And so while there may be selective enforcement, it's only within the regime that's there legally. They can't stop somebody from performing. There are seemingly ample spaces. I'd be surprised if you're hearing that there just aren't enough spaces for whatever Keith and Abby were really concerned, you know, when they got busted for painting those squares downtown, that there were not going to be enough performance spaces. It seems like everything in that story is going pretty good.
So you've occasionally gone down there or had your ear to the ground for that kind of stuff?
Yeah. I mean, you can see all the open spaces being unused. Nobody's complaining that there are too many, you know, that I can't find a spot to play. That we were really worried about it because of the Borders corner or the Forever 21 corner and then New Leaf corner going away, because those are the prime spots. But they did open up some traditional spots like that one facing the street of Forever 21, right next to Rosie McCann's. That is a brilliant spot with your back to the wall. That is a coveted spot now.
It's the only one, though.
Jay and his friends, and all of that group of people are constantly playing, and then you see a lot more spots. I think it was interesting. When they put some of those spots, what they did was, you know, some of those spots prior to the brass discs hadn't been seen as viable spots because they just didn't have the right feel or tradition. Now, some of those spots are traditional performing spots. So, you know, something maybe, good did come of it after all, that some of those spots are now seen as viable performance spots when they hadn't been before.
I notice also there seems to be a change in the vending situation where handicrafts are now being allowed. They're not being, you know, driven away unless, you know, the rule was it has to be written material or painting or music. It can't be, you know, your leather work. It can't be your jewelry. I saw, I guess, birdhouse teapots on Pacific Avenue.
Yeah.
But I do also notice a lot.
That's automobile based, though. I haven't seen a lot more. But still, Jaya in his raps are not. He's still unable to.
Oh, really?
Every once in a while, you see some stones out there, and I think it's hit or miss depending on whatever the Rangers are willing to write. And
yeah, you could be right.
Completely sophisticated in the rules, if you notice that.
Say that again?
Oh, it's hit or miss. It's either selective enforcement and selective awareness by the Rangers themselves. They don't all know all the rules. Sometimes they walk blindly by, you know, somebody skateboarding. Mm-hmm. And other times they're, you know, they're rabid. So it's a weird, you know, you never know what you're going to get. So we see people with jewelry down there for days, and then other people who've been selling jewelry down there for years still are not unable to sell their stuff, like Jaya and Jason, who has the, you know, the leather hat. He sells his stuff in the seated area of Coffee Roasting Company. You might see.
Yeah, you're thinking of James, maybe.
James, yeah. So he's still not out. You remember, he used to table, and now he doesn't do any tabling.
Yeah, he got heavy ticketing, and he was...
Haven't
heard anything about those two artists who were displaying their paintings and became a cause célèbre?
Yeah, you know, I think that one of them is back. I think...
Joff and... Alex Skelton. Isn't that Alex Skelton? I think it was.
Mike Joff? Brilliant, and then the other one was even more insanely brilliant and articulate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
big, dark one.
Big into the First Amendment. But they ended up getting, of course,
so good,
steamrolled over by the ordinances. Well, that's, I guess, another issue.
I don't think we know what ended up happening with them. I bet they ended up getting spanked so hard that...
They did a tour around the country for a while. I know that.
Yeah. So the van, the big yellow van is back in town, and you can see the tall, brunette, lanky guy driving it around. But I haven't... and I don't know his name. I don't have his contact information.
You think about Alex or Alex Skelton?
Yes, that's the one.
That's good. Yeah. I'm glad to hear it. Although these guys were loners. They didn't want to form coalitions with anybody. But, you know, they did their thing, and they tried to assert their right to be artists, you know?
Yeah. I guess we're all a little wrapped up in our egos, every one of us.
Not me. I'm above all that. Well, listen, thank you for taking, and now it's we're getting even close to an hour. Anything you want to add before we poke on?
No, thank you.
All right, remember, for folks who want to get in touch with you, I actually wanted to ask you this.
I really want people to come out to this meeting
On the 11th.
February 11th at 7 o'clock at the Homeless. Loud enough. I
got to
go. Thank you.
Before you go, one last question, Brent.
Yes.
Is there a place online where people can get the specifics about these particular proposals that you're trying to put forward, these different models? Where can you go?
Facebook page is Coalition on Homelessness. Hold on a second. Hi, what about this? You're not. WarmingCenterProgram@gmail. I'm sorry, warmingcenterprogram.com. I gotta go.
Thanks, man. Bye-bye. And the number to reach him at is 222-1234 for the latest information on whether the warming center is open and possibly more details about the day and night storage program and other programs he works with. He also does Santa Cruz outside. Is that right? Santa Cruz outside in homeless outside in Santa Cruz, I think is the proper way to say it.
And now a brief change of pace as we wander over to Pacific Avenue.
Anonymous, if you want. We're talking with a woman who's selling, how would we describe these items?
They are teapot birdhouses, a little home for the birds.
But no birds, I noticed.
Well, not right now, but they do like to stop in on top of the van.
Ooh, really, do they?
Yeah, they dive bomb the van all the time. It's kind of cute.
Now, we're here on Pacific Avenue. These are handicrafts that you've been doing for how long now?
About a month.
And you came to Santa Cruz how long ago?
About a month and a half ago.
And you said you had an unusual visit from the police?
Well, it wasn't our visit. We just happened to be in the vicinity of what happened.
What happened?
They were trying to get a couple people out of a car, and I looked up about 8 to 12 cop cars with guns drawn, getting people out of the car. And so I reached up to plug my phone in real fast because I wanted to get, yes, and I got rear-ended so freaking hard. The cops hit the back of the trailer. I went flying forward. I jumped out, and he's got a big shotgun, you know, and he grabbed me and was like, move over. And it was just insanity. That was like our first week here, so they have totally left us alone because we didn't sue the hell out of them.
So. It's one way to make a little bumping back on this. Yeah. What did they tell you was their pretext for doing this?
Robberies up and down the coast.
So they had to bang in your van because there were robberies?
He forgot to put it in park.
Oh, well, that happens.
It happens. He was a rookie.
What was his name?
I can't remember.
It's convenient for them.
I know, right? No, they did a report and everything and made sure we were all right and checked up on it. So,
have you ever been hassled for doing this on Pacific Avenue? Because if you tried to do this a year ago, they would have stopped you.
Would they? Yeah. No, we've never been hassled. Actually, the Rangers came by and said, awesome work.
Wow.
Yeah, so pretty neat, huh?
I see you're inside the sacred disc area, sort of.
Inside the disc area for
mostly.
Hours. Yeah, for the most part.
Might be dangerous if you weren't.
These little brass circles or whatever.
Things,
yes.
You have to be within.
You have to be in the perimeter of these things.
But you're slightly outside the perimeter. Yeah. Officer?
Yeah, right. The other day I put my other little display up right here too, next to it, and they never said a word to us.
Well, I think that they've had some problems now with those ordinances, but I'm hoping that they have more problems and return to a freer, you know, more natural approach to the whole thing.
Have you had to move every 2 hours?
Not once. We haven't had to move at all. They let us sit here and they don't hassle us. They're very nice, actually.
Well, you do, of course, give a nice touristy quality to the town, you realize.
I love it. You know, this is totally what Santa Cruz is all about. It's the repurposed redwood, California redwood, okay, and the repurposed teapots and the California driftwood. How can you get more Santa Cruz than that?
And how long does it take you to make one of these?
Anywhere from a half hour to an hour, depending, you know.
And did you do this other places?
No, not really. In Bremerton, up in Washington by Seattle for a minute, but we were traveling. State parks, remember, we haven't seen one yet, but that was our whole goal.
And describe for us what one of these is like. Use your own language, because it's a combination of different things. There's usually you've got a cup on the bottom on top of a sort of a wood frame, and then a kind of a cuckoo clock looking frame, or a clock like roof like. Well, you describe it. I can't
describe it. It's got a roof to keep all the weather out from the birdhouse. The birds have a nice little home, and these are either used as a feeder or a bird bath.
You're pointing to the teacup.
Yes, pointing to the teacup. And then the bird house is actually the teapot with a driftwood perch put on it, and then driftwood for decoration on the top and on the middle. And sometimes we do like little jewelry and things, and maybe something pouring out of the teapot. Yeah, little beads coming out. Yeah.
Yeah.
We had a guy came out of the bar the other night, and he goes, "Is this an elaborate way to pour tea?" So we're like, "Have another drink." But no.
And do you want to say who you are?
My name is Laura.
Thank you, Laura.
Uh-huh. My husband Greg's going to be sad. He wasn't here for this. He likes the attention.
How can people get in touch with you if they want to get one of these items?
I have a card right here.
Your website?
We don't have a website at this time. We have an email and a phone number. Phone number is 509-879-6447. And the email is gregorymoore194@gmail.com.
And these are, of course, handicrafts, and therefore we're not simply backing some commercial rip-off artist here Pacifica.
All original right here.
Laura?
Laura, yes.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
And some days later, Daniel came to the Huff meeting. That was actually just a few days ago, last Wednesday, which will be held again next Wednesday, along with a Conscious in Action meeting. I think we're doing double-barreled Conscious in Action / Huff meetings every week now, though it's not entirely clear since I don't determine the schedule of the Conscious in Action meetings. But they both happen usually around 11 o'clock on Wednesdays at the Sub Rosa Cafe, which is right next to the bike church at Spruce and Pacific Avenue, 703 Pacific, to be exact. Anyway, Daniel had a story to tell, and here's that story.
What's your general locale? Come in. Come in.
This is my auntie.
Welcome, auntie.
Hello, how are you?
What is your name?
Sylvia.
I'm Robert.
She has to take me to an appointment. I just wanted to come in and check it out because he was talking highly of the place.
Oh, well, good work, James. Luring people in here. Cool.
Okay.
Would you like a cup of coffee?
Okay.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Sure.
All right, have a good day.
Hey, thank you. So, are you indoors? Or you're outdoors these days, but what part of town are you generally in when you're outdoors? Or are you rotating?
Like the downtown west side area. Yeah.
And hassles or not?
Yes, there's hassles.
Example would be most recently.
It's like they just, when I say they, I mean like the police and rangers, it's like they tell you to go one place and then they come over there and then tell you to go another place. So it's like they just keep you going. You can never get comfortable.
Yeah.
So give us an example of, like, most recently, how long an interval between the time their arrival first time and the arrival the second time?
Let me think. Honestly, it's been a while since I've had that hassle, because when I get tired, I'll just go, they have that Tent City over there.
How is that?
And, honestly, I don't like it there. I just get bad vibes.
Have you had any stuff stolen or not?
Have I?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
at the tenth city or not?
One more time?
At the tenth city?
Yes, at the tenth city.
How frequently?
Have I had stuff stolen?
Yes.
I've only had two things stolen, two different skateboards that I had. Mm-hmm. But other people, everyone gets something stolen every day.
Yeah.
So if you want something stolen, you should go to the 10th city.
Yes, most definitely.
So we can recommend that.
If it's not stuck to you, or if you fall asleep and it's in your pocket, it's going to disappear probably still. It depends how soundly you sleep. Mm-hmm. But eventually you have to sleep.
And I didn't see it, but my friend said he's seen someone ODing off of drugs, and he said people were going through his backpack and taking his stuff. And that honestly, disgusted me.
Yeah.
Even though, we're out here in the streets, we still gotta have, some self-respect and, morals and
kindness.
Right?
Do you have friends out there?
I do.
And are you in phone contact with them?
A few. A lot of them don't have phones.
And how many, say, nights in the last month have you spent out there?
In the last month, three.
So mostly you don't?
Yeah.
And is that recently, those three nights, or sometime?
Yes, the last three nights.
And you intend to go back tonight?
I'm going to try to get into the loft. I have to talk to Brian. But if not, my sister said I can sleep in her car. So I think I might just do that. And my sister stays at the Reveille shelter, and so I can't stay up there because it's for women and their children. So.
How do they like it there?
They like it a lot. They've been helping them with housing, and they had a house on Lower Ocean at the Sleep Tight that they were going to get, but their housing wouldn't accept it because it still needed some work inside the house.
This was the Sleep Tight, or it was near the Sleep Tight?
No, it is the Sleep Tight. Yeah.
Oh.
And I'm tempted to play more from the Huff meeting since it's very energetic and has a lot of interesting specifics that don't come out in the general wash, certainly not in the mainstream media, and often not among the established social service or even activist discussions. But I also want to make sure that I don't play stuff that I haven't given or gotten the permission from folks who spoke out to speak and pass that on to the broader community. So it's going to have to wait. I did get a call from Cherie, one of our Huff members, who has been spending a lot of time. She's an older woman who has been living in an RV, but now had moved to the Pauley Loft, which is part of the homeless, what I call the Homeless Lack of Services Center out at Coral Street. And she called in to report that there have been no shower facilities or hot water available for the last 3 weeks at the Pauley Loft, impacting, I'm presuming, 20 to 40 people who live in the loft, and perhaps other people who use the Homeless Lack of Services Center to try to get showers or just wash up or maybe wash their clothes. I don't know if they have a washing machines there that people use. They might. Not sure. So I contacted the Homeless Lack of Services Center to find out if perhaps Cherie was exaggerating or what was going on. I got a woman named Sarah who refused to tell me who was in charge of that, said that they did have a boiler problem, that the issue had only been a problem for 10 days, that it was a budgetary problem, they couldn't really fix it so quickly, and I said I wanted to talk to whoever was in charge. She refused to give me that person's name or number and hung up on me. So I then contacted another employee at the Homeless Lack of Services Center who had previously actually tried to help out Cherie and claimed that he was still trying to help her. Cherie had said she hadn't heard much from him and hadn't gotten much help when I talked to her about this guy. But he did confirm that the boiler had been out for 30 days. And so Things are getting pretty smelly over there, according to Cherie. I then put through a call to Drew Glover, a council member, who called me back pretty quickly, said and researched it, said that he had learned that, in fact, there was a boiler problem, claimed that it was going to be fixed within 10 days. He talked to Director Phil Kramer, and that they had no options except to go shower over at the Monday through Friday noon-only showers at the St. Francis Soup Kitchen. And he couldn't quite figure a way to address it. The shower trailer on wheels costs $10,000. I've been trying to get the budget of the Homeless Lack of Services Center for several years, and Phil Kramer, the director, has declined to provide that for me. So has this other worker who has otherwise been quite helpful, who I talked to get the confirmation on the shower situation. And I asked, I don't know if I asked Drew if he would get me that budget or not, but hopefully I will, and put that in again, because my point has been in trying to understand why the Homeless Lack of Services Center not just has allowed homeless people that it's supposedly serving to remain filthy and unshowered, not being able to wash their hands with hot water for the last 30 days, but rather for the last 2 years, 2.5 years actually now, the Homeless Lack of Services Center has not provided the meals that previously it had provided at least once a day, and I think it's been twice a day for the last 10 or 15 years, to the general community who came in and sought a meal. As of June of 2015, under Phil Kramer, the new executive director, they stopped providing meals. And, of course, now behind closed gates with guards and ID cards and a whole list of rules, until recently, this pathway to housing criterion for getting into the emergency shelter, it's no longer emergency shelter at all. It is simply one of those bogus programs to housing, pathways to housing that don't really exist, but that take your checks and money and also make a record so that they can make more demands for or requests for grants from state and government and federal government agencies. Anyway, that's kind of an update on my latest contacts with the Homeless Lack of Services Center. I think that that calls for a little music, however, to ease the pain.
Hey, you keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. Hey, you've been messing where you shouldn't be messing. And now someone else is getting all your best. And these boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. And one of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. And you've been lying when you ought to be truthing. When you ought to not bet. Hey, you've been saving when you ought to be changing. And what's right is right, and you ain't been right yet. And these boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. And one of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. When you ought to be changing, and you've been thinking that you'll never get burnt. Ha! Well, I just found me a brand new box of matches, and what I know, you ain't got time to learn. And these boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. And one of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Come on, boots, get walking.
You've been listening to the music of...
Frank Cardiac and the Heart Attacks.
We're the Heart of Gold Band. and Jay, and we got Mandolin Mark and Johnny Mandolin Mark.
Yeah, we got the dual got marks.
Wait a minute, who's on the washboard?
Mark D and Mark S.
Sticky Sweets on the washboard.
There you have it, folks. And going back a little further, here's a story from January 9th. With?
Angela Lean.
Angela, we're here in front of the nightclub sports bar, and you say that they came up. Who came up?
Two officers. And they said I needed to stand up.
You needed to stand up.
Yes. And then they said to go in these squares or certain designated areas.
These squares, yes.
Yes.
The disc areas.
Oh, the disc areas. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Oh,
here you are. You're outside the disc area. Look at this. You're such a scofflaw. What are you?
Am I in a disc?
No, you're not. These are square. We're both square. They're the square. So you, how long ago was this?
About 10 minutes ago.
And you seem in a cheery mood. They didn't debum you out, apparently.
No, they didn't. They were friendly this time, yeah.
And have you been doing much playing on Pacific?
Well, I don't know them, but I've been here for three days.
And where from?
Eugene, Oregon.
And how does it compare with Eugene as a guitarist on the streets if you did that there?
Well, they threw me in jail for singing a Satanist song once.
Say that again?
They threw me in jail for singing a Satanist song.
Now, would you like to do a reprise of that song for us?
Well, absolutely. Yes, yes.
Go for it. Let's hear it. Is this your own creation?
Yes, it is.
Go for it.
Hey, mother, I worship Satan. Hey, mother, I have the mark of the beast. I'm not welcome home for Christmas. I have no family. I made my family the demon. I am the fallen angel. I am the Antichrist. I am the fallen angel. I am the Antichrist.
And we've been listening to the music of
Satan. What's that?
The music of
Mona Lisa.
Thank you, Mona Lisa.
You are welcome.
And anything you want to add before we... This will be on free radio tomorrow night.
Make sure and rock the entire world out.
I can't promise that, but it'll be on the radio tomorrow night. Thank you, Mona Lisa.
Right on.
All right. Anything you want to play or say for free radio?
Sure. I'm free radio, huh?
Yeah.
What's your name, brother?
I'm Robert. Give you
Robert,
mic.
How you doing? I'm Matthew.
I'm Robert.
Yeah. You're out here just documenting stuff, huh?
Pretty much. That's you know, cool. Grabbing someone, see how police treat people on the streets.
Yeah, let's go there. That experience wasn't that bad. I've been beat six times by Santa Clara cops, and I've helped run protests against police brutality, and like my point of view on them is they're nothing but Roman soldiers 2,000 years ago.
Similar to?
Yeah, to, I mean, Roman soldiers 2,000 years ago. That's pretty much conductive how they run today.
Same old shit.
Same old shit, different badge, different outfit.
No, Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz.
Compared to Santa Clara, it's a lot more tolerable. It's still jail. I mean, if you look up Sweden and how they conduct, like, stuff like
Have
that.
Have you been there yourself?
No, I about as fact-checked as much as I could without being there, you know?
You don't have the money to fly to Sweden?
Of course not. Not in this economy or this situation. But, no, like, the cops are... I don't know. It's a touchy subject. I don't want to be documented saying one thing, but it's not...
Well, speak your mind and, you know...
I will, but I always want
to... Let the heavens fall. Hopefully not on you.
Oh, just in place. Now, if they do, then they're supposed to be that way, right?
Yeah, I don't know about that.
I mean, like,
as long your name, partner?
As long as there's a heaven, you know. My name's Matthew.
I'm Robert. I think we said that a moment ago, but
did.
You told me again,
yeah.
So thank you.
I'll play a song.
Go for it.
Cool.
One of your own composition, perhaps? Yeah, sure.
Right. You're going to, like, let me win my money tonight, right?
Yeah, I'll be up there.
All right. Compositions, yeah, it's about an ex-girlfriend. And, yeah, I'll play it. You ready? Let me know when you're ready. Go for it. I'll let you know when I'm ready.
Tuning up here.
What'd you do to me? Now it burns and I pee. Don't give me no shit about a UTI. It's probably those 800 guys on your Facebook, Snapchat, Twitter. Hold on. Well, you can't get... I don't trust that code.
I really will leave him to his devices. Now, I'd hope to find more, but I have a growing interest in and perhaps even a sense of solidarity with the Yellow Vests or Yellow Jacket movement over in France and other countries. I'm going to play a couple of brief news blurbs from the... This is the 11th week of their protests, which have gotten panned a lot on the mainstream media, and mainstream media seems to be only interested if there's some violent interactions between the government, the cops, you know, and the protesters, who are mainly peaceful, but still arriving in masses to challenge the austerity policies of Macron, the French Führer, as I call these heads of government who operate seemingly in democratic under democratic forms, but are actually have no real accountability to the mass of people in this country, similar to the presidents and legislatures in the United States. Anyway, here's a couple of blurbs. And this first clip is an example of how the Yellow Vests have spread beyond France. It's from Iraq, actually.
Yellow is now the color of protest in the southern Iraqi city of Basra. Angry crowds, mainly of young people, have adopted the brightly colored vests first seen in demonstrations on the streets of Paris a few months ago.
Our Yellow Vest movement symbolizes the rise against corruption by the people of Basra and Iraq. We are wearing these yellow vests to deliver a message to politicians that even simple oppressed protesters can make a change.
About 70% of Iraq's oil sits beneath the land around Basra. Yet people who live here say little of the money comes to them. The city's electricity supply barely works. The tap water is undrinkable because it's full of salt. And there's high unemployment.
Enough is enough. The Iraqi people have been suffering. We need to wake up. These politicians are making a joke out of us. They can't even resolve their differences in parliament. How can they manage a country?
Street protests began in the summer of 2018 when barely functioning air conditioners couldn't stave off the burning heat.
The protesters in Basra blamed the problems in their city mainly on corruption in corporations, but also in parts of the government, which is based here in Baghdad. Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdelmaki went to visit Basra just recently to see the problems for himself. In October, his predecessor, Haider al-Abadi, did the same thing. But despite these high-profile visits, the people of Basra say nothing has changed.
These latest protests are different. This time, they're organized. Basra's Yellow Vests say they want to join forces with other protest groups and put even more pressure on the government.
Basra is always going to be a boiling pot, and the situation will go out of control if things aren't solved.
The color of protest in Basra may have changed, but the problems are still the same. Rob Matheson, Al Jazeera, Baghdad. Yellow.
And here's RT giving its perspective on the 11th round of the Yellow Vest protests in Paris.
Police have fired tear gas and water cannon at protesters on the 11th consecutive weekend of yellow vest demonstrations. Adi Charlotte Dubinsky reports from the rallies in Paris.
It seems like it's all falling apart at the moment. Andy, I just want you to get a look behind you. You see people moving away from this main street here in front of the Bank of France. That's because that's where the tear gas is coming. And as you can see, people throwing projectiles towards the police forces who are trying to move those protesters back. They've been here in the Bastille for the last hour or so, fairly calm. And then about 10 minutes ago, decided that they were going to try and march down this street. This is Rue Saint-Antoine. And as you can see, it's now descending into a chaos between the protesters throwing these projectiles and also trying to throw back the pellets of tear gas, which has been brought forward by the police. You might be able to see the protesters actually set fire just in the distance there outside a shop that's covered in scaffolding. And that is one of the reasons they're trying to push through. You can see that they've been moving these barricades here, be moving these away because there's lots of work undergoing at the moment here at the Bastille, trying to move it to create what seem to be barricades again and then setting those on fire. As you can see, those projectiles coming now from all angles of the crowd here as they try and hit the police and possibly other targets. So yes, it was calm. We were expecting it to be a calm protest on the 11th weekend, but yet again we're seeing more violence from the side of the protesters and the police then responding to that. You might be able to see a row of the CRS, the gendarmes, are coming there, and that looks like they're trying to put out the fire that was created by the protesters. I think that's a water cannon. Yes, I can confirm water cannons have now been brought in to try and deal with this situation.
Of course, what's not being mentioned here, although it's kind of hard to tell exactly what's happening from this brief account, is the police, at least in earlier marches by the Yellow Vests, simply blocked them and stopped them from getting to the center of government. And in response, they tried to push forward, and the police then used violence to stop them. So it was the police who were violent, and in the protesters in response defended themselves or expressed their outrage that they were being attacked by the people that they're paying to supposedly protect the constitutional liberties of the country.
And you can see more security forces there as these pellets, which we're literally in the path of at the moment, are being chucked towards the police. Now, this comes as France is in the middle of a national debate. Just behind us there, they've smashed the bus. That's all going down. Really is coming into quite chaos here. As I said, they are in the middle of a national debate here in France. And that itself...
Of course, this national debate is a sort of a mock debate set up by the government as its attempt to show that it's actually discussing policies. But in, I guess, the opinions of many of the protesters, they aren't being discussed or really taken seriously at all until apparently what they take seriously is property damage and masses of people on the street who essentially ignore the police or push back against the police, as is often the case in countries where, well, most modern countries, where the legislature is in the hands of the oligarchy and where the country is suffering under austerity policies that have nothing to do with the real will of the general public or their general welfare.
Has been angering people. Look at that, the water cannon trying to push that temporary barricade that the protesters have put up, pushing it away so it can get closer into this crowd. These rocks that the protesters are throwing are actually coming incredibly close to us. So we're going to just try and get some...
And again, you have this focus on the response by the protesters as though it is initiating, it is the aggression... it's hard for me to fairly say that that's a bunch of horse shit from an establishment news media person, although I am in fact saying that, but I can't really accurately say that. I'm not on the scene. I can't see that. But It seems clear that what the police are trying to do is break up the protests. And not because the protests are violent, but because they don't want the protests to threaten the power of the government. Because they're ordered to do that.
Cover behind a tree here at the moment. We do have our safety gear on. Look at that, the water cannons in full force now, trying to move those protesters away. Absolute chaos here. We're just having to move quite a lot because that water...
And actually, water cannons don't just move you away, they injure you. They can hurt you. And this sort of notion that these are simply crowd-controlled devices is a pro-police fantasy that this media is promulgating.
We're just having to move because that water cannon is coming round. We've just seen some people injured, including one of our colleagues in Ruckley. Looks like he's received an injury as a result of what I assume are the projectiles being thrown from the protesters, from the crowds. We are.
She assumes that, but she doesn't assume it's happening from the police, or perhaps tear gas being thrown, or perhaps the water cannons hitting this guy. She's got the various assumptions that are sort of in line, probably with her salary, her class position, her level of income. But I could be wrong, too.
Trying to keep undercover here. The police, as you can see, they are getting their flashballs out now. This is to launch the tear gas. We have been told that the police officers who are using these flashballs will all be wearing body cams today so that the material can be reviewed afterwards. It's not clear how many security forces are out today. The Interior Ministry normally gives us figures. This week they've decided not to, so it's anyone's guessing game just how many security forces are out. But as you can see here, they're trying to push those crowds away. They've been successful, and now they are launching the tear gas in a bid to try and calm the situation down.
Why would tear gas calm the situation? He's using all these words that indicate some sort of gentle persuasion. It's the kind of stuff you'd find on a police department's report after they brutalized a bunch of people and then suggested what they were really trying to do was to gently control what's going on.
Down here, I'm being told, there you go, you get a sense of the forces coming up. But yeah, complete chaos within just a few minutes once again, as Act 11 is certainly underway here in Paris.
Well, several people were injured in those clashes. One protester, identified as a popular figure within the Yellow Vest movement, suffered an eye injury. He was taken away by paramedics.
And it's interesting how twisted things get, at least from my, perhaps my twisted perspective, in that you have these heavily armed, heavily armored, well-organized thugs in uniform who are attempting to break up popular protests. And they are supposed to be considered to be the guardians of law and order. And so what they do, we have to examine their tactics with interest, sympathy, and sort of implicit support, it seems to me, or at least view them as somehow equal combatants to this huge number of unarmed people who can be injured, who can be arrested, who can be jailed, who for simply demanding rights, trying to get together to change policies that are immiserating the country. That's how I see it. But to get back to our own police force, here's a earlier report from yesterday from a nutcracker Nick Whitehead, a Conscience in Action activist who called me when I was recording this show. Okay, well, today is the 26th, I believe it's the 26th of February. No, January, there we go. And I'm talking on the line with activist Nick Whitehead. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Quick report. 1 o'clock today, Saturday, I was at the car vehicle. As I got closer, I saw there were no less than nine black uniformed police officers, city police there. So I went up to one. His name is Escalante. He's the younger brother of Rudy Escalante, who's retired now. And I said, what's going on? Can you tell me? And he said, well, there was a stabbing incident in last night, and we're looking for the culprit. Mm. Wow, do you need nine armed police to look for one culprit? Mm. So I moved on because I wanted to find some people to help carry water into the camp that I had bought. And I was talking, and as I turned around, I noticed there were two of the officers standing there. They had submachine guns, the huge, you know, big, ominous-looking submachine gun. And so I said to them, you're looking for one culprit. Do you really have to bring the tax squad with these arms in? Oh, well, we're police, you know, that's what we do. Mm-hmm. And on further questioning, the whole squad turned away from me and got back in a big black van and started backing off down the levee.
You faced down the tax squad. Shame on you, Nicholas Whitehead.
I mean, I think it was the tax squad. They're the only ones who carry machine guns.
No idea, but...
I mean, I've never seen that before. I've seen it in San Francisco, but never here.
Huh. Interesting. Did you talk to anybody there and get any of the reaction of the folks in the camp?
I talked to a few people who helped me carry water. Nobody wanted to talk to me about police actions in the camp. In fact, the woman said, I don't have any trouble with the police. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't able to gather attitudes, or I didn't go into the camp. I was on the periphery. Mm-hmm. And that's all I can say. I've got to roll off now. I'm late for a date, okay?
All right. Well, have a good date, and thank you for the report, hombre.
Yeah, sure, man. It just happened. Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye.
And if you've been listening to this broadcast earlier, you may remember the lengthy conversation with Brent Adams, where I mentioned this conversation I had with Nick, which happened actually before I spoke to Brent. And Brent seemed to treat this as some sort of a normal situation. As, oh, yeah, well, those are just the police. But guys showing up with submachine guns in nine strong to look for one individual, it's, I guess there was a stabbing downtown, is what Brent said. It seems to be not just a form of overkill, but a form of terrorism against the population. And what's worse than what the police are doing, although that's pretty bad, is the reaction of people, frankly, like Brent, who seems to regard this as somehow a natural, normal, and acceptable part of police practice. And I find this particularly surprising because Brent in the past has been a protester himself. Now, of course, he's seeking to get grant money. He's doing good services to try to help homeless folks in a real ways. But does that mean he abandons his principles with regard to the abuses of the police department? And by abuses, I don't mean necessarily the fact that they're shooting people with the machine guns, but even carrying the machine guns, appearing in massive numbers, creating a form of fear on the part of the community. That doesn't reassure, I don't want to say it doesn't reassure anybody. There may be some people who do get sustenance for that kind of thing, but it sure as hell doesn't reassure me, I'll tell you that. And before I play this last account from Steve Plaich, Silver-Tongued Steve, as I've called him, as well as different, less friendly names on different occasions. Here's a message he forwarded to me from Sarah Mason about a visit to the Ross encampment that happened today. I should say yesterday, Saturday. And, well, here it is. Hi, comrades. This morning, approximately 12 DSA, that's Democratic Socialists of America, members met at the Ross encampment to distribute a large amount of food, bananas, tangerines, a million Costco muffins, croissant, trail mix, dried fruit, coffee, hard-boiled eggs, and apples, bottled water, toiletries, such as toothbrushes, toothpaste, tons of pads and tampons, cleansing wipes, wood pallets, beanies, scarves, socks, trash bags, and medical supplies such as Band-Aids, extra-strength Tylenol, regular aspirin, and low-dose aspirin. When we arrived, we entered a closed metal fence that separated the path beside the river leading to the encampment from the parking lot at Ross's. It's unclear why the fence was there or who closed off entry from the parking lot. We had to untangle several metal wires to open the fence, but to open the fence, we were successful. Note to self, always travel with wire cutters. We set up near the entrance to the camp where we encountered a man from the local Lutheran church distributing hot pre-packed food. I was immediately worried that our effort would somehow be redundant. However, it was not, as the needs of the encampment seemed to far surpass what any one person or group can reasonably provide. From what I could tell, the encampment appears to have grown in population since our action last week. Obviously, it's hard to know since residents are in and out depending on the time of day. Once we set up the table, comrades poured in with boxes and boxes of supplies. It was a phenomenal mobilization of resources and incredible to see. We organized the supplies on and around a fold-out table. Vicky brought a tablecloth with a floral print and placed a small vase with flowers in the middle. We want bread, but we want roses, too. Approximately 50 to 65 residents gathered around the table and formed a loose line. In the future, it might make sense to have multiple tables set up to distribute supplies. That would allow for items to be distributed faster, but it would also allow us to talk to people without feeling rushed. We gave folks whatever they asked for if we had it. 2 muffins, 3 muffins, entire boxes of tampons, entire boxes of Band-Aids, whatever they asked for, we provided it. Again, people asked what organizations we were with, and we told them the Democratic Socialists. "You're the ones Fox News hates," a resident said. "Yep, that's us." I spent most of my time at the table distributing food, but many of our members talked to residents about the needs of the camp and what's been going on there lately. I asked someone if the cops bothered them at all. They replied, "Not really," but said that people who are exiting the freeway yell at them and throw things at them every day. Some comrades took notes on what people said they needed and are better suited to report back on this, but from the information I've collected from Joe, Elise, Vicky, and others, here is what people seem to need. Tarps, tents, wood pallets, bulk water, hand warmers, so many people expressed the need for warmth, flashlights, on-site medical care, a way to charge mobile devices, people have phones but no way to charge them, oil for lamps, sleeping bags, socks, trash bags, duct tape, cleaning supplies, bleach and sanitizer, sign-making supplies, art supplies, underwear, heavy jackets, gloves, hats, beanies, zip ties. Some of us discussed the possibility of bringing literature next time, maybe a flyer or something that explains who we are and what we're about. Joe and I are going to draft something before next week using the mutual aid flyer as a kind of template. We also thought it would be good to provide contact information on that sheet. I, maybe naively, asked a resident if the camp had a process for making decisions collectively or dealing with problems that arise. He said no, and that they have actually been dealing with a lot of arguments lately. Some DSA members responded to the last report by encouraging us to help the camp organize a meeting. I'm open to this idea, but really unsure of how to go about it. Any thoughts? The question of politicizing this work is also an open one. We didn't have an opportunity to debrief as a group, but I encourage everyone to put their reflections into the Housing Working Group Google, the Google group. If you aren't a member, send an email to Vicky and she will add you. Lastly, if you think your work is important and you want to support it, or if you think this work is important, please, please, please contact us at Venmo at DSA-Santa Cruz and put Ross in the comment area. If we could raise $200, we could easily cover the cost of this week's distribution. Looking forward to discussing this more at next week's meeting. Solidarity Forever, Sarah. Sounds good to me. And here's a more establishment look at the Ross camp from the mainstream media.
Began as a handful of tents, has exploded into a small community along a stretch of Highway 1, and city leaders are saying they can't tell the homeless to leave. NightBeat's Maria Medina with business owners who are feeling stuck in the middle.
As you drive into Santa Cruz off of Highway 1, this is now the first thing you see, a stretch of tents almost as wide and long as a football field.
Drug arrests, we've had cars broken into.
It's the price Michael Spadafora says he is paying right now.
Somebody tried to light my bathroom on fire.
His coffee shop, he says, is taking a 10 to 15% hit, and he's not the only one.
That's the operating budget margin for most of our businesses here.
And the hits may continue to come.
Right now, we're just trying to manage health and safety with the campers.
City leaders say they are very aware of the homeless encampment that's dramatically grown in the last few weeks, steps from the Gateway Plaza Shopping Center. In fact, they say they've put out toilets, trash bins, and hygiene stations for the dozens who've moved on to the property.
What would you say to somebody at home who's watching this and saying, well, why can't you just tell them to leave?
We can't actually tell them to leave. It's against the law now.
A new federal law makes it illegal to cite or arrest someone for sleeping on public property if the city or county doesn't have enough shelter beds. The county reports 80% of the 2,200-plus homeless are unsheltered.
And there's some sadness in my heart that this is the life that some people are, that this is their only option.
Carrie Goodman lives in Santa Cruz and says something needs to be done.
You guys want to help carry this box?
Today, she and a group of local moms visited the community with food.
This is our highest priority right now in our community, and so we are actively looking for ways to house these people and shelter them.
For now, city leaders say they are doing what they can, but others, like Michael, say not fast enough.
A lot of us are small businesses, and we can't keep sustaining this.
And the property the homeless encampment is on is owned by the city. Tonight we saw the police chief stop by. Santa Cruz just got $10 million from the state to spend on the homeless, but they say it'll take time to decide what they'll spend it on. On the NightBeat, I'm Maria Medina.
Of course, the arrival of the money is one of the reasons why suddenly everyone's so interested in addressing the homeless, as well as the fact that there isn't a new federal law. The news media is mistaken there. It's rather a court decision about the Constitution. I guess you might call that a federal law. It's considered to be unconstitutional to go after homeless people. Cruel and unusual punishment, a violation of the Eighth Amendment, because people have no choice but to be outside if they have no place to sleep. And to then punish them for their status is a form of unlawful, it's actually a form of torture. Sleep deprivation is also a form of torture, but just the notion that because someone is homeless, you can punish them for that or diminish them, make them less of a human being, deprive them of sleep, deprive them of the right to rest, is suddenly something that the courts have said the cities will have to pay a cost if they start enforcing these laws that they've had for years here in Santa Cruz, liberal Santa Cruz, as well as elsewhere. So that's good news. But, of course, the bad news is that the city's latest approach is to cram everybody into one campground, exciting the rage and a concern of both business people nearby and residents, because folks without any funding, without any resources, some of them will be engaging in petty theft. Others will be simply living in squalid conditions, which frightens middle-class people who somehow feel this is a scandal that this happens, when in fact it's happening all over town anyway, just hidden away. But if it gets visible, oh no, that's pretty frightening. And that's something we don't want our kiddies to see. But it also has to be said that this is prompting a reaction of conscience for some folks, and that is good. Let's listen to Steve Plaich fielding questions from me.
It's around, 6:35. I'm talking with activist Steve Plaich on the line. He's about to bound off to some other charitable or social service activity, and he has a report, kind of, on what's been happening today as a both a witness and a participant. Is that fair to say, Steve?
Well, kind of helpmate, sort of. Last week, the Democratic Socialists of Santa Cruz County put together kind of a small visit out to the Ross Camp. It was not called the Gateway Camp, but call it what you will, and kind of passed out some necessities of life and whatnot, but really worked hard this ensuing week to put together some really significant types of supplies. My contribution kind of was, they keep me in the email, and I do needle exchange, as you know, out there every Thursday with Denise Ellerick. But my contribution was, I ran into Chris Youngren, who's a downtown outreach worker, yesterday, and she had some tarps and hats and socks and the like. So I kind of put her in touch with Sarah Mason, who you saw the email from, a Democratic Socialist, who kind of ramrodded the trip they had out there today at 10 o'clock. I guess there were 12 of them, and passed out a whole cornucopia of things to support the campers out there.
Steve, how many times have you been out there now, would you say?
Oh, I'm out there at least two or three times a week. I do one food distribution morning with stuff that we get from Second Harvest, kind of excess things that we get. Mel and I go down to Second Harvest in Watsonville and shop for the coffee house and a couple of other places. So I've customarily now, the last 2 weeks, picked up extra canned goods. They have, you know, peanut butter, applesauce, kind of soups, cases of water, which they really need out there because they still don't have a consistent water source. And then I shuttle those up there. And then, of course, Thursday we come back and do the needle exchange, Denise Ellerick and Jennifer Lanford and myself, from 12 to 1 or 1 to 2, depending on schedule. And then I'll probably be up there one other time or so, just kind of checking on stuff, you know, seeing how the ground cover is, you know, looking at the kind of evolution, if you will, of the camp, and see really how it's developing.
How has it changed in the last few weeks, if it has at all?
Well, I think in the last few weeks, people seem to have solidified their structures. You know, when I was out there, say, a month ago, and they didn't have the mulch ground cover, it was muddy, you know, getting to wet. But a lot of the tents out there were just kind of tent poles or kind of had fallen into, you know, either incompletion or disarray. But as I went out there this last week, all the tents are looking very stable, very sturdy. I think people are beginning to settle in out there, and I think that they're beginning to, you know, maybe it is the beginnings. As you know, we had one of the fellows from the camp came to our conscience and action meeting on Wednesday. So maybe they'll at some point develop some sort of not a leadership structure, but at least somebody to be a point person for food distribution or, you know, accessing whatever the needs that they have as they go through the winter.
Have you established many contacts out there where you can get in touch with people by phone and get a sense of what's going on?
Not so much. We do have personal contacts when we go out there and needle exchange, and so there are, you know, certain people in certain tents that we know, but they tend not to, you know, want to publicize their substance habits, and that's, we respect their confidentiality and privacy. I don't know. You know, everybody's got a cell phone these days, so almost everyone. Until we start taking more accurate statistics when we're exchanging needles, as you know, when we had the Santa Cruz syringe access, we took scrupulous statistics about how many needles were returned, how many were distributed. And along the way, you would be able to get some contact information from people when they felt comfortable enough to give it to you. So we kind of let that, develop organically. People have to trust you just because they're out there, giving them fresh needles, which is really something that they want because they're very, very mindful of the importance of harm reduction and the image that that has to the community to try to avoid people dying. Unfortunately, we had Ralph Rodriguez, who had died out there. Interestingly, I don't know if I sent you that information. He was one of the homeless folks that pulled the folks out of the burning car.
Wow.
Yeah. Hmm. Ironically, he was older, had real health problems with diabetes and that thing, but he was the fellow who passed away. But it hasn't been as frequent as it was in Santa Rosa Park, which is one of the reasons why the community started to get a little antsy about it, because they perceived that as being a dangerous spot in the urban core, a lot of drug use, and a lot of drug deaths. So the people who are out there that we've talked to, kind of the leadership of that group, is really mindful of the importance of harm reduction. So to that extent, you get to know people, but, it's a... They have privacy rights, in my view, that shouldn't be violated just because you're out there helping them out.
Now, this campground, the Gateway or Ross Campground or whatever you want to call it, is considerably, first of all, more crowded and has more people than the San Lorenzo Campground did a year ago. And also, it's less spacious. It may cover more as much territory. I'm not quite sure. I can't really estimate it. But I mean, there's a lot less space between tents, although more space than between the what I call the Boneyard Barbed Wire River Street campground that was funded at a $90,000 per month cost before.
Well, that was very cramped out of River Street, as you know, just because of the design and because of the small footprint. The footprint probably of this Gateway camp is probably just about the same as the San Lorenzo. It just doesn't seem so much that way because they're number one, more tents, and number two, they're closer together. So yeah. there's the kind of the pathway down the middle of the camp, if you go out to the Gateway Lost Camp, that's really pretty wide and spacious, and they've got trash cans that the city has donated and put out there, like every 6 or 8 feet. So they've been able to keep that kind of avenue. Runs all the way from the top where the porta potty and hand washing section are, all the way down to River Street.
I've noticed that the number of trash cans since a couple of months ago has multiplied considerably. There seem to be much more frequently. One of the things you mentioned was a concern is the presence of Sharps containers for the proper disposal of hypodermic needles and syringes. How's that going? How many such distribution containers are there out there? And I'm asking you about it. How many would you say are available throughout the city in different places?
Oh, there are very few. In fact, Denise and I were talking about there's a cement pad that's right around the Felker Street walking bridge out there, we're thinking that would be an ideal place for a large needle kiosk. We feel like if there's needle exchange out there frequently enough, and Denise is doing... We just expanded to Watsonville, which really has nothing to do with the camp, but we're out there every Thursday consistently, and then they also do an exchange Sunday night in Harvey West. So we feel like the more exchange you have, the less you need the strategically placed kiosk. They'd be great to have. They should have them up. They should be available, in many public places. But when we go out there, we make sure that one of the things that is really needed, and one of the things that we distribute are various size biohazard containers. We have them that are big as a garbage can, it's a trash can, or a kitchen trash can, say, right underneath the sink, and as small as three or four inches in diameter.
How many would you say you distribute on an average trip out there, or in your last trip out there?
3,000. We started...
Not 3,000 containers, but 3,000...
Oh, no, the containers?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, we take as many as Denise can get from the... She has to get those from the county health services. So The smaller ones, we probably have 20 of. The larger sizes, they're harder to get, so maybe 30 in total. But people always have those. We try not to require people to take the tops off of their biohazard containers and dump their needles out and reuse their container. It's just not a good practice for anybody. They're happy to do it if we don't have a container, you know, to replace the one they're using. But by and large, we like to give them a fresh container each time. So, as the program grows, what we had with the Santa Cruz Experience Access was we had a storage locker over Etching Seabright that had hundreds of containers. So we went out, we would have, you know, as many containers as people needed.
When did that end?
They chased us out in 2012, I think.
Now, is that in 2012? Was that before the infamous ending to the needle exchange in the Lower Ocean neighborhood, or after?
Yeah, that's right, just after.
And has there been any indication that this council is going to turn that one around and restore needle exchange?
I don't know. We're kind of working on restoring it ourselves. I mean, needle exchange, syringe exchange programs called FEPs are licensed, regulated by the state. They're not licensed or regulated by the city or the county. So they can, if they like, say, you know, we appreciate what you're doing and we're going to support it. But they honestly, unless, you know, the needle exchange folds its tent, which unfortunately that group did a while back, we can revive needle exchange and have it in a number of locations and have an all-volunteer needle exchange. It's an harm reduction model, which is, you know, replacing used needles so people don't use them over again. You know, it can work, but you have to have enough exchange sites so that people can easily access them and be able to follow the harm reduction model itself. The problem with the county is that they have limited hours. In my view, they don't really know the community very well. One of the things that we found was that if you do exchange all the time, you get to know folks, and you can anticipate or kind of get a feeling of when they might be interested in making kind of a life path change, and in which case then you can direct them, you know, to some rehab or something that's available. We had, right at the end of our needle exchange program, we actually had money for scholarships. Somebody come in and say, you know, I really need to change my life. Can you help me out? We'd be able to give them, you know, $500 or so to get started, which isn't really enough for a rehab program. But it's, you know, to get started, you know, down a different path. So,
and that ended when the council in closed session drove it out of the neighborhoods in the lower ocean.
Yeah, it did. Regrettably, the people who were making the decisions then just bumfuzzled that whole public relations situation. It could have been handled, and the needle exchange could have survived had they not really been so arrogant and completely disregarded any concerns the community had about their professionalism, or whether it was a one-to-one exchange, or whether or not you know, there were problems in the exchange neighborhood, which there weren't. So that's as much on Santa Cruz Syringe Access as it is on the city council and the residents.
You know, earlier in this program, I got an interview with someone who told me that, in his opinion, there was almost a huge majority, if not almost everybody, out in the campground is, to some extent, needle-using. What's your sense of what percentage of the population out there uses needles regularly?
Well, when we do our exchange, and now we have some kind of statistical base, although it's not a recorded statistical base, but having been out there, our observations are that we generally service about 25 or 30 people at a time. So it's not as large a percentage. And I mentioned this to the chief last time I talked to him.
Chief of police.
At the Chief's Advisory Committee meeting, we had a long discussion about needle exchange last most recent meeting. And I said, listen, here's my observation. You know, it's not an open-air drug bazaar where everybody in that camp is using needles. That's just simply not the case. Even if some people who are using it, there aren't exchanging with us, even taking that statistical anomaly you know, and pulling that into, you know, what the percentages would be. It's just not, you know, if there's 30 or 40 people, 50 people using out there, that's, you know, 40% of the population or 35% of the population. I don't know how that would compare to the general population, since, you know, we always found that most intravenous drug users were housed, not homeless, another myth to explode along the way. But, you know, it just doesn't come as news to you, I'm sure. But it's not that everybody, people aren't there because it's a place for them to be able to use intravenous drugs. They're there because it's a place of safety and community and security and a place where they can store their stuff and have somebody else watch it if they have to do something, presuming they have friends in the camp. There's a lot of positive aspects. And not for nothing, you know, they've created this space for themselves, and the city and county has completely let them down.
What do you anticipate? You are also on the police chief's advisory buddy group, as I like to call it.
Yes, I am.
And you, there's concern that this campground is going to be dispersed because, of course, that apparently is what he is assuring people at the tannery and people on Price Street and on Felker Street who want to, although less harshly than the Take Back Santa Cruz crowd, restrict, move the porta potties to the other side of the camp, and
interestingly enough, I just that group of people reached out to me. I had a chat with them, and I can't give any details about it. But I will say that we, you know, kind of reviewed some of the ideas that they have. One of the things they would like to do is close the Felker Street walking bridge, which is not supported by everybody that lives in that Felker Street area. But there are some other proposals that they'll probably bring to council at some point. The chief can say, because the community needs to hear it, that it's not going to be a permanent solution. Certainly it's not going to be. You can say that truthfully. Yeah, it's not going to stay there forever.
Now, regarding that Felker Street Bridge proposal, I talked to some of those tannery folks outside the last city council meeting on Tuesday, and they were saying that the bridge they want closed is the one that goes under the freeway that's between the tannery and the camp. It goes up, that is essentially, I never use it, it's a walkway path, not the pedestrian bridge across to Felker Street and Denny's. Did you have a different understanding if they want that bridge closed?
Denise mentioned to me as we were walking across the Felker Street walking bridge this last Thursday that there was some discussion about closing that bridge at night. I don't know how in the world they could do that. So you're probably more right than I. It is. The neighbors are just, you know, the community is concerned about the obstacles that they're encountering to enjoying the levee. You know, everybody's got to live in the same space as part of the social contract. So, you know, everybody has to make compromises for the greater good. But they're, you know, complaining about the fact that they can't access certain parts of the levee, or they can't access the exercise track, or they can't go over to the tannery. And at some point, they'll work all that out. But, I mean, my suggestions would be that if the Homeless Garden Project ever does finally get themselves going and moves out to the Poganip, they've been talking about doing forever, it's possible that, you know, we could get some kind of a homeless encampment out there on that Homeless Garden Project, at least temporarily, say for a year, because it would take that long for Swenson to get any kind of development through the Planning Commission and City Council. He could just as easily say, well, I'll rent this to the city for a year for a dollar, and it put the homeless encampment out there.
Now, you were present at the Wednesday meeting, as was I, of the Conscience in Action that kind of segued into Huff, but there was a lot of hubbub and concern and planning for an upcoming city council meeting, the second one in February, or the first one in February, Tuesday, for a number of specific changes. What was your sense of what came out of that meeting? You've seen a lot of chitter chatter about these issues, and you've been rather skeptical about, you know, the protest approach to these things at different points, although you've also been a supporter of the protests at different points. What's your sense of what's likely to come out of this process, which Drew Glover and Chris Crone and more important activists were involved in?
Well, I'm encouraged. I think they're going about it the right way. I think they're soliciting from myself and Mike and serious people who have serious programs, for instance, his bathroom program, my RV, parking program, who are, I already sent in, and you probably saw it, you know, my agenda report format of how that would be presented. It makes it a lot easier for them to actually take that to council or take it to, an agenda meeting and say, listen, we have these proposals, and they are in the kind of formats you can take a look at and discuss and determine whether or not you want to put them on the agenda. So I'm encouraged, you know, so long as Drew has his interns working on it, and so long as Chris seems to want to, you know, push it forward, I'm encouraged that at least the RV parking program and Mike's ideas about the bathroom, those are in a form that the council can look at as an agenda meeting and say, hey, okay, let's go ahead and agendize it though for a full discussion. So I'm cautiously optimistic.
Now, regarding more serious reforms around, in a sense, the campground is itself a needle injection, self-created experiment for those who are hard drug users. But in some cities, they're considering needle injection and inhalation centers where people can, you know, safely shoot up and, you know, engage for harm reduction purposes.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, existed in Vancouver for a couple decades now and in some European countries. Have done any research on that, ever visited those programs, have any sense of that?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, they had a pilot project to actually pass the state legislature where they were going to have a safe injection site for a 3-month pilot project in San Francisco City and County, and the governor didn't refuse to sign the bill. So California, it's dead for now.
Unless people do so as actually needle exchange did, began sub rosa.
I don't know what the legalities of that are. I'm not even certain what that would look like. If you had, you know, you open someplace, I'm not certain you could get a use permit for a building, for the permit to be injection drug use.
Well, that's your legal training, Steve, coming out. I mean, remember how marijuana decriminalization started in Santa Cruz? It didn't start when they asked for a permit. They set up, you know, the place on Maple Street.
Yeah.
And then they also...
I'm just not certain that everybody will get a business license to do it.
I hear you there, but...
And I think they would probably close it down if they tried to open it without a business license.
But needle exchange began without those permits, right?
Needle exchange is a different thing. I think needle exchange, you're just, you know, the visual of it for the community is, well, harm reduction, you want to keep people sick, it really costs a lot less than hospitalization, emergency room visits, you know, it's a good thing, so let's go ahead and, you know, not chase that out of town again, but to actually have a fixed facility where drug users come in to safely inject drugs. I'm not certain that, you know, they had a hearing at the Board of Supervisors about that very thing when the legislature was identifying municipalities that might want to do it. City and County of San Francisco was the only one that actually offered to do a program. But they had, you know, the Torch and Pitchforks folks came over to the Board of Supervisors and were adamant about Santa Cruz, you know, could not, would not, should not be a candidate for that kind of program.
Now, were you around?
I don't know how that worked out.
Were you around when the, you know, the same, I imagine a similar pitchfork gang came to try to stop needle exchange when it was originally sub rosa and illegal and being done, you know, below the line?
And I don't know what that program looked like, you know, so I can't say what the reaction.
When did you come to town, Steve? When did you arrive here?
Oh, 1999, 2000.
Yeah, that was
I
later.
I didn't really get seriously involved until about 2006, so that predates me.
Gotcha.
So I don't have any idea what that program
is. So what's coming up that you want to talk about that you think people should know about for the next week that's happening on the horizon?
Well, what is going on? We have another conscious action meeting, I guess. We're doing a program tomorrow night on CCV about Don't Bury the Library. So maybe there's an opportunity there to change that policy, so that'll be fun with Gene Brocklebank. So that's something that people might want to listen to. 7 o'clock CCV,
Comcast Channel 27, or you can stream it at communitytv.org.
That, of course, is the issue of building a five-story or four-story, I'm not sure how many stories, parking lot with a library in the basement, right? Or
on there you go. Yeah, absolutely. So we'll be talking about that.
Is there any indication that the council members are going to actually take any action on that? Have you had any, heard any, you know, positive?
I haven't heard. They have so much on their plate right now. I mean, I'm happy that they're willing to take some time to seriously deal with some homeless issues. I'm delighted that they're doing that. But when you have, you know, people banging on the doors of rent control and just cause eviction and affordable housing and all of those stuff, they have their hands full. You know, they met three times this last month. It's unusual. So, and I'm all for them having special sessions. They should have a special session on homeless issues alone. But, you know, so long as they seem inclined to really seriously deal with homeless issues whilst they're trying to deal with all this other stuff, I'm more power to them.
Now, at one point recently when we talked, I cornered you in the kitchen of the Red Church.
Yes.
You said if some homeless person came forward with a ticket wanting to challenge the failure to pay business where they send these fines south if people don't appear in court, even without a hearing, they suddenly impose these fines on people and have been doing so for the last 3 or 4 years at least, that you would be interested in taking such a case in terms of your legal training.
Oh, sure. In fact, not the same issue, but I'm helping Lee Myers. You know, he got a ticket for
loitering.
Sidewalk and loitering against bridges. So we are now working on his appeal. In fact, we're just working on it this last Friday. So he has filed his appeal, and we're working it up, and it's going to be heard.
The reason I ask about this case is that I've been following Lee's case somewhat, but this is the kind of thing, and his isn't unique, that other people are facing that same kind of situation, but this practice of imposing a fine, doubling the fine they're giving people for these outrageous so-called quality of life crimes, and then sending them south, which then interferes with their ability to get a driver's license, get their credit okay, even get an apartment, maybe get a job. I'm not even sure of all the different kinds of problems that, you know, having this crap on your not paying these huge fines creates.
Well, I couldn't agree more.
But,
it's just
but the question I have for you,
it's a matter of getting good facts, and you get good facts. And
well, the question I have for you is, it's not just the good facts. It's a question whether, you know, you divide yourself rather thinly. You do all kinds of different things. One fact almost always finds you in motion around the community, and the real question for some of us is, do you actually, I mean, no one's going to fault you if you say, you know, I got too much to do. I can't do all this stuff. You know, it may be quite a job to pursue that kind of a case.
The only difficulty and the reason why it's been so easy to work with Lee's case, to move that forward, is that he's been pretty focused on it. So what generally happens, somebody says, you know, I want to sue the city about this and other thing, and then, you know, because, you know, they're homeless or they're trying to survive day to day, it's hard to kind of chase them down or get a meeting or, you know, get the kind of background information you need to really do it. I don't mind doing that stuff, but that's what burns my time, is trying to kind of get people, you know, focused on it enough to really be able to help them.
Mm. Well, you've given me at least 30 minutes, if not more. I can't quite see.
All right, happy to do it.
Anything you want to add or conclude with or emphasize or
no,
say?
No, we'll be at the Red Church on Monday. I'm sure I'll see you there, and moving into another month.
I guess so.
Hi, Robert.
Thanks, Stephen. If people want to reach you, how can they get a hold of you?
466-6078. It's my cell. I'm happy to talk to people about nearly anything they got going on. We're trying to do our part.
Thanks, Steve.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.